And here are some of the latest developments in the global coronavirus crisis. U.S. biotech giant Pfizer and German partner BioNTech are seeking approval to roll out their coronavirus vaccine early, a first step towards relief as surging infections prompt a return to shutdowns that traumatized nations and the global economy earlier this year. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration, or FDA, says its vaccines committee will meet on December 10th to discuss the request for emergency use authorization. Russia registers record numbers for daily infections and deaths from the coronavirus 2 days after having passed 2 million cases. Health officials reported over 24,800 new infections and 476 deaths, bringing the national total to over 2.6 million cases and more than 35,700 fatalities since the beginning of the year. Meantime, Russian President Vladimir Putin told G20 leaders on Saturday that Russia was ready to provide its Sputnik V coronavirus vaccine to other countries who need it. Russia is also preparing its second and third vaccine, Putin said, adding that the creation of a vaccine portfolio was a common goal. France is preparing to reopen stores for the crucial Christmas shopping season, encouraged by new data suggesting the country is past the worst of its second wave of infections. Thanks to curfews and partial lockdowns, confirmed new infections dropped by 40% last week, admissions to hospitals fell by 13%, and the number of new intensive care patients was down by 9%. According to the National Health Agency. And U.S. President Donald Trump's eldest son, Donald Trump Jr., has tested positive for COVID-19 and is quarantining without symptoms. This is VOA News. Rockets have hit residential areas of the capital, Afghanistan, Kabul, killing at least 8 people and wounding over 30. This is what Afghan officials are saying. The attack happened an hour before a meeting between U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and Taliban negotiators in the Qatari capital, Doha, in an effort to resume peace talks. The Islamic State group says it was behind the attacks. Earlier this week, the outgoing administration of U.S. President Donald Trump announced plans to withdraw 2,000 troops from Afghanistan by mid-January. The decision brought concern regarding the Afghan government's ability to deal with militants alone. Europe's aviation safety regulator believes the Boeing 737 MAX is safe after a lengthy safety review and expects to clear the aircraft for commercial flights in January, its top official said in remarks which were broadcast on Saturday. On Wednesday, the U.S. Federal Aviation Administration lifted a 20-month-old grounding order imposed after two fatal crashes that triggered cockpit design changes. U.S. commercial flights are due to resume in late December. The executive director of the European Union Aviation Safety Agency told the Paris Air Forum that his organization wanted to carry out a totally independent analysis of the safety of this aircraft, so they performed their own checks and flight tests. An American jailed in 1985 for spying for Israel was released from strict parole conditions, allowing his move to Israel. That word came from the Justice Department. Jonathan Pollard served 30 years for giving away classified U.S. documents. He was released from prison in 2015, but was confined to the U.S. by his parole terms. Israel has been applying pressure to allow him to leave. Pollard, 66, was a U.S. Navy intelligence analyst in the mid-1980s when he made contact with an Israel colonel in New York and began sending U.S. secrets to Israel in exchange for tens of thousands of dollars. He passed thousands of crucial U.S. documents to Israel, straining relations between the two allies. Declassified CIA documents released in 2012 indicated that a 1985 raid by Israel on the headquarters of the Palestinian Liberation Organization in Tunis was planned with Pollard's information. Some 60 people died in the attack. Pollard was arrested that year and was sentenced to prison 2 years later. After his release in 2015, he remained subject to a curfew, had to wear a wrist monitor, and was prohibited from working for any company that lacked U.S. government monitoring software on its computer systems. Via remote, Laurel Boone.
From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News. Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week via Skype, Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal, Abdulrahim Fukara, Al Jazeera's regional director for the Americas, and our moderator is Shana Estulin, political and foreign affairs correspondent.
Thanks for joining us. Here are the issues. The coronavirus pandemic spiraled out of control. Some good news as several highly effective vaccines appear to be within reach. And more than 2 weeks after the U.S. presidential election, President Trump continues to claim widespread fraud without evidence. Plus, the U.S. is set to draw down troops from the Middle East. What will that mean for U.S. national security and for that region? Tom, Abrahim, it's good to talk to both of you again, and we have a lot to talk about for this week's news. Let's start with the pandemic. It's been 8 months. It's clearly not going away. The numbers in the U.S., over 250,000 people have now died. That is a quarter of a million people. And you're seeing record new number of cases in recent days. States are now considering a second round of lockdowns. Tom, how did we get here?
Well, to be very blunt about it, I think because a lot of people in America just decided that wearing a mask was not necessary. And many millions of people in many states just stopped social distancing. We keep seeing on the internet these pictures of parties with 50 or 100 or many other people drinking and having a great time not wearing masks. And I think there has been far greater transmission than we've seen for 6 months. I think a lot of people believe President Trump when he said we're rounding a corner. All the data shows that at the moment, very sadly, we're not rounding a corner.
Yeah, the president is claiming, though, that he has done a lot and that there would be many more lives lost without his leadership. But a lot of people are asking, where is he right now? He seems to have sort of disappeared, even as the number of cases go up and up, and we've now hit this really awful milestone of 250,000 deaths. We haven't really been hearing, Abrahim, much from the president on the pandemic.
No, we have not. I always say that I've been in the United States now for 20 years. And obviously, this country has gone through many different crises and shenanigans and has always been able to land on the right side of finding a solution to move on. But I've never seen anything like this in terms of the shenanigans going on about the result of the election and what that means for the pandemic. I mean, it was expected over the spring that come the summer, the pandemic would alleviate. That didn't happen. Then people were saying, well, maybe in the fall, things may get better. And that didn't happen. But we haven't heard, as you said, much from President Trump, because it seems to me that he's so preoccupied with the election situation and the shenanigans over the result of it with Joe Biden. But Joe Biden, it has to be said, especially over the last couple of days, he seems, without, you know, angling this in any way which may be seen as cynical, he seems to have found a way to actually consolidate his position a little bit in terms of warning Americans that unless he starts getting the information he needs to get from the Trump team, the impact of the pandemic in the United States is going to get a lot worse.
I'm going to just stop you there because we're going to talk about the transition and the hiccups there for our next topic. But certainly you are hearing complaints from the Biden team that because they're not officially certified by the obscure federal agency that does that, they're not getting access to the coronavirus task force, the data there, the resources the U.S. has. And so that when they do come into office, presumably January 20th, they're not going to be able to have all of this time to have been working on trying to get the country in a better shape for the pandemic. But we're going to talk more about that in a little bit. Tom, I want to go back to you about this idea of pandemic fatigue. We do have these two vaccines that appear to be highly effective that could possibly end the pandemic from Pfizer and Moderna. And there's a third one from another big pharma company. But we're also being told by public health experts that it's going to be months until these vaccines are widely distributed. So what do you think that's going to do to the American psyche? Is that going to sort of tell people, hold on and you know, stay safe until we get there? Or is it going to do the opposite? It will discourage people from taking more precautions because they feel like this is almost over.
Well, I think there's going to be some of both of that. I think there is incredible pandemic fatigue, and this is good news. Even health experts who have been critical of President Trump handling of all of this are saying this is the closest we're going to get to a gold standard of vaccine and testing, but it's going to take a while. I mean, unless you're a first responder or a healthcare professional, you may not be able to get the vaccine for several months. I'm hoping that more Americans will decide to rally around the notion that help is on the way and we can hold on for a couple more months and then we'll have vaccines. On the other hand, there are so many people out there who spurn masks. All the experts say that masks will stop the transmission or at least limit it significantly, and there are millions of people who don't believe that. It's troubling. I wish we had somebody in a position of leadership to say to the country, listen, ladies and gentlemen, here is the deal. If you don't wear your mask, somebody's going to die. It may not be you, but it might be a family member. It might be your grandmother or your grandfather or your aunt or your uncle, but somebody will die. I don't believe it's registering to the degree that it should.
Or that it did in the spring when this all started, and people seem to really be paying a lot more attention. And as you said, the months have been dragging on. And even though hospitals are now feeling overwhelmed by the amount of cases, people just don't seem to be focused on this. There are other things going on, certainly the election, which we'll talk about. But yeah, you mentioned the critics are saying President Trump's sort of flip-flopping on masks and wearing the masks has not helped. But then you have in California now, the governor of California, a Democrat, he's in a lot of hot water because there are pictures coming out. He was at a dinner party, no masks, no social distancing, and he's been telling people in his state, you have to be careful, don't gather for Thanksgiving, you need to be wearing masks, and he's not practicing what he preaches. So there's certainly mixed messages coming from a lot of areas and from different parties in this country. But I want to get a sense of what's going on around the world, Ebrahim, and I want to bring you in on this. Give us sort of the global snapshot of what's going on in Europe right now. They're dealing with another surge. Iran is facing its worst COVID outbreak yet. What steps are other countries taking? And the big question, like we're seeing here, are other people in other countries listening to their leaders?
It seems that there's a second wave, a second surge of pandemic happening in pretty much everywhere, a lot of places in Europe, as you mentioned, in Africa, other parts. Africa seems to be the surprise of the season, if I may call it that, because the norm has been, at least in the Western media, to say, you know, as far as pandemics and diseases, Africa is always ranks at the top, except that this time Africa seems to be doing quite well, at least in comparison with other parts of the world, including the United States. And that's a result of how various African countries have worked very closely together throughout the pandemic. You know, the result now is, at least now, we don't know what's going to happen in the future, but at least now the Africans seem to have a better handle on the pandemic than the Americans or even the Europeans. The Europeans, in terms of the reactions of the governments in Europe, there was a lot of concern, obviously, during the first wave. We've seen horrendous numbers in countries like Italy, for example, is really battered by the pandemic. But this time around, governments seem to have rallied around the idea that they have to work together and extend financial help to Europeans. You have countries like Germany, a powerful, rich country. You have even less rich countries such as Greece, basically helping companies, helping ordinary citizens financially to deal with the impact of the second wave. And that seems to have created a lot of, if you may call it, satisfaction among the people in Europe vis-a-vis what their governments are trying to do.
That's a really good sort of point to jump on, the economic fallout and what countries are doing to help people who are struggling financially. Let's talk here, Tom. So Congress pumped trillions of dollars into the economy, but they seem to be stuck on the next relief bill. How far apart are the Democrats and Republicans? And any chance something gets done before the new year?
Well, I hope so, Shana, but it doesn't look like it at the moment. They're not talking. The Democrats and the Republicans in Congress are about $1 to $2 trillion apart. And you get the feeling that especially the Senate Republicans have dug in their heels, are not going to support that kind of a figure. You would think that the country's legislative leaders would get together and say, we have to do something of an interim nature right now before the end of the year. And at the moment, they're not interested in doing that. And, you know, people are dying, people are out of work, people are literally going hungry. And it's, it just seems to be a very callous game here. But everything is more or less tied up with the election results. And the end result of that is that Congress is paralyzed at the moment. It seems astonishing, but they are paralyzed at the moment.
Republicans will say they want to pass a skinny bill that's more targeted, and the Democrats are countering that a lot of money has to be thrown at this problem, and there are a lot of political fights going on right now and back and forth. But as you say, meanwhile, people are really struggling, people are dying, and people are losing jobs. It's a very big problem, especially for local governments who need extra help to deal with this crisis as well. And this is not a problem that's going to go away. I'm certain we're going to continue talking about that. Let's go to a break. And when we pick up from the break, we'll talk about the election, the results, and the transition, which both of you have mentioned. It's a big story. Let's get on to it.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal. Abdulrahim Fukara, Al Jazeera's regional director for the Americas, and our moderator, Shayna Estulin, political and foreign affairs correspondent.
Welcome back. It has been more than 2 weeks since the U.S. election, and President Trump still refuses to admit defeat, even though major news organizations have declared Joe Biden the winner based on ballot counts in key swing states. The president and his allies continue to try and overturn the result of the election, but their legal challenges aren't going so well. In fact, they've lost nearly every legal challenge so far. Abraham, they seem to be having difficulty proving this widespread fraud.
They do. And as you said, they've tried different avenues in different states, which would be important to the overall result. But so far, those haven't panned out in any significant ways. They may be able to change the count by a few hundred here, even a few thousand there, but that's not going to impact the overall result, which is that Joe Biden has carried this election. But, you know, if you wanted to be a little bit charitable to Trump, it has to be given to Trump and to his camp that they're not giving up. I mean, they're coming under intense pressure from the Biden camp, from even some of the Republicans in Congress and elsewhere, but they seem to be determined to continue. We don't know exactly what the end game for President Trump is. So far, he hasn't caved into pressure. And I also have to say that that's obviously raising concerns for many Americans about what that may mean for the democratic system in the United States and more immediately for the national security of the United States.
We'll get to the national security implications in a moment, and that's a really good point. But to Abraham's other point, what does it mean for the democracy when you have, Tom, new polls showing that at least half of Republican voters believe this election was rigged? They believe President Trump here, even if there's so much evidence to counter that.
This is very bad for democracy, Shayna. And let me remind listeners, President Trump is the 10th president I've covered. I started covering the White House in the last months of the Lyndon Johnson administration. So I've got some institutional memory here and institutional history. And I can tell you that none of the presidential transitions since Lyndon Johnson have been as contentious and as challenged and as contested as this, except for Bush versus Gore, but that was a legal challenge over a handful of votes in Florida. I can remember that when Jimmy Carter lost to Ronald Reagan, Jimmy Carter not only called to concede that night, but he promised President Reagan this will be the greatest, most successful transition in history. And every president who has lost for re-election, and all there was a transition between all of those presidents, and they all were relatively okay. But you've never had a situation, in my experience, where millions and millions and millions of Americans, mainly Trump supporters, believe that the election was stolen. And there is no evidence of that, but these are people who will not be deterred in that belief. And that is fundamentally bad for democracy. It's really bad also that the transition work has not been allowed to go forward because President Trump has said no transition until we get this sorted out.
even if President Trump does concede defeat, I mean, he's still going to be a major figure in the Republican Party, especially if he does decide or if he insists that he's going to run in 2024. Is that, Abraham, why you think we're seeing many Republicans, although some have sort of admitted that Joe Biden won, but we're seeing congressional leadership like Mitch McConnell, the leader of the Senate, not saying that Biden won because they don't want to get in President Trump's sort of crosshairs?
Possibly, but you'll have to remember that among the very many unprecedented things about the 2020 election, I would defer to Tom, obviously, in terms of his knowledge of previous administrations and how they've conducted themselves in transitions and during their administrations. But I don't think Americans have ever seen anything like President Donald Trump, both in terms of him saying what he thinks without worrying too much about being politically correct, but also in terms of the base that he's cultivated. They seem to believe in him and they seem to believe what he says through thick and thin. I mean, it's probably another instance of unprecedented that you have a president of the United States who was defeated in the election, even after about 70 million Americans have voted for him. And probably not all of those 70 million are his base. So he will continue to wield a lot of influence. Whether that's the reason why many Republicans are reluctant to say to him bluntly, you've lost, you need to move on and concede so that Joe Biden can become the legitimate president of the United States. But regardless whether he runs in 2024 or he doesn't, I think the base is here. His legacy is here. Whether he disappears after this election or he stays, it becomes a huge challenge for Joe Biden to try and build bridges with the current base of President Trump, not just in terms of economic policy, but, you know, even in terms of science. This whole issue that President Trump has instigated among his base, that, you know, they don't have to wear a mask and that the pandemic may not necessarily be real, that's going to be a major challenge for Joe Biden moving forward, and maybe even in the election in 2024, people will continue to contend with this unprecedented polarization which currently exists in the United States.
It's a very big problem, and it's a good point that it's not only an issue of just unifying the country in general, but also around this issue of defeating the pandemic, or at least bringing the numbers down and getting everyone on the same page on the science. The other issue, Tom, is that there are many Republicans who feel like the Democrats have vilified them. And so there's a lot of just distrust and conflict on every side here in this country. It's going to be a big challenge to Joe Biden going forward. What are some of the other domestic issues Biden may face once he comes into office January 20th, Tom?
His immigration policy. He wants to roll back Trump's view of immigration. He wants to stop construction on the wall along the southern border with Mexico. He wants to raise taxes on wealthy Americans. The other one I would say is climate change and environmental issues. He wants to roll back many of President Trump's initiatives in this area. And a lot of Republicans in Congress don't want him to do that. So he's not going to be able to do as many things as he had hoped he would be able to do.
Yeah, certainly, as you point out, it's going to be much more difficult for him because the Democrats lost seats in the House. So they have a majority there, but it's a smaller majority. And they thought they were going to sweep the Senate. And that certainly didn't happen. Plus, you have the Democrats. There's infighting there between progressives and centrists. So Biden is going to face challenges not only from the Republicans, but from his own party. And then on the foreign policy front, Abdulrahim, I want to bring you in. What kind of challenges does Joe Biden face there?
Let me first of all say one theoretical challenge, which is the fact that it has to do with U.S. democracy, the way it's constructed. The president of the United States occupies an extremely powerful position, despite all the checks and balances of the U.S. political system. He can introduce change, he can change policies, the policies adopted by his predecessor, and that's his prerogative, and so on and so forth. But one challenge that he will face, let's take the Iran deal. Obama basically concluded that deal together with U.S. allies, with the Iranians. Then came President Trump, and he basically trashed it. And the issue for Biden will become, with other countries looking at that and saying, well, you know, if I conclude a deal with the Biden administration now, what guarantee do I have that the next administration administration will uphold and preserve that deal. So that's one challenge. But there are other challenges in terms of the policy with Iran itself. Biden is likely to want to bring back some aspects of the Iranian nuclear deal with Tehran. Obviously, President Donald Trump has made it very difficult for him to do that, but there, he still has a margin of maneuver. There's the issue of Israel and Palestine. President Donald Trump has basically taken U.S. policy in an unprecedented direction by moving the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. Obviously, Biden, I do not see how he can try to reverse that. He may want to go back to the two-state solution for which many people in the U.S., including many Jewish Americans, are clamoring because they're worried about the future of Israel as a Jewish state. China, I don't see how Biden's policy could be very different from Trump's policy, except that Biden will probably be a little bit better spoken about China. But the crux of the policy and the challenges that come with that policy will probably remain the same.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack in your answer. And certainly on China, we are seeing a hardening of rhetoric coming from both parties. So as you say, it doesn't seem like a lot will change there. And then with the Palestinian-Israel issue, so much has changed on the ground with Gulf states now normalizing relations with Israel, something that even some of the Democrats are praising. And then lastly, on the Iran deal, you know, Biden has said the U.S. would come back to the deal if Iran came back into compliance, but Iran continues to breach the deal. And plenty of critics of the deal, including some Democrats, believe the deal didn't go far enough to address Iran's other malign activities in the region, like funding terrorist groups and developing ballistic missiles. So this is not easy. This is going to be very complicated for Joe Biden. I want to stay in the Middle East because the U.S. this week announced that they're going to be withdrawing additional troops from Iraq and Afghanistan. You had the acting Secretary of Defense, Christopher Miller, announcing the U.S. is going to pull more troops from those countries, leaving around 2,500 in each country, down from 4,500 in Afghanistan, 3,000 in Iraq. This is all supposed to take place in mid-January, so just days before Biden gets into office. Tom, this is something, though, that President Trump has promised since his 2016 campaign, that he's going to be pulling troops out of the Middle East, getting the U.S. out of forever wars. So is this much of a surprise?
No, it's not that much of a surprise, except for the fact that his Joint Chiefs of Staff, his military leaders, and his civilian Pentagon leaders all oppose this. And the Secretary of Defense, Mark Esper, sent a classified message recently to the White House saying this is a bad idea. So what happened? He was fired by President Trump, and we now have an acting Secretary of Defense, Christopher Miller, who will be there no longer than 8 weeks, the maximum. So it's not surprising that Trump did this. It's a little surprising that the president essentially ignored his entire military and defense chain of command, which he, of course, has every right to do. But whatever else it means is it means there's going to be turmoil in our policy in the Middle East. Of course, it raises the question of whether the remaining 2,500 troops in Iraq and Afghanistan are enough to do the job.
And Abraham, I'll let you have the last word here. What are regional players saying about this withdrawal and U.S. allies?
There is concern, first of all, about the withdrawal from Afghanistan. There's concern from the Afghan government itself. There's concern from some of the U.S. allies. There's concern from NATO that the time is not really right for withdrawing from Afghanistan. Many of these countries are pointing out that the Taliban continues to launch, and even President Trump's critics here in the United States are continuing to point out that the Taliban continues its attacks in Afghanistan. The time may not be right. Ditto for Iraq. There's a lot of concern. The green zone in Baghdad, which is the most important part of Baghdad, where the U.S. embassy is housed, came under attack in recent days. So a lot of people are cautioning that the timing may not be right. But I just want to say this to conclude, especially about Iraq. There will continue to be discussion about whether the U.S. should be militarily in Iraq or not. Whether you agree with it or not, there is absolutely no way for me that the U.S. can completely withdraw from Iraq, because Iraq is so central to U.S. strategic interests at this point in history.
Yeah, this is going to be certainly another challenge that the Biden team is going to have to contend with once they get into office. And that is all the time we have. Thanks to Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal, and Abdurrahim Fakara, Al Jazeera's regional director for the Americas. Great analysis from both of you. I really appreciate it. This program is produced by the Voice of America. I'm Shana Stulen. Thanks for listening and stay safe.
From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is Rick Pantaleo, broadcaster and producer with VOA's Current Affairs Desk. Rick is also host of the Science Edition of Press Conference USA and VOA's Daily Science in a Minute. Our guest, Mark Lagon, Chief Policy Officer of the Friends of the Global Fight, and that's a nonprofit organization dedicated to advocating for increased U.S. spending, investment, and leadership to end the world's three largest epidemics, AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria. We'll be talking with Mark Lagon about the Global Fight's work in the area of pandemic preparedness and the organization's official transition document for the incoming Biden administration entitled U.S. Global Health Leadership for a Safer and More Equitable World. In it, the Global Fight's website says it broaches five mutually reinforcing priority actions for a reinvigorated U.S. global health strategy, such as increasing U.S. global health investments and aligning them with other public health programs, rallying the world to end the three biggest infectious disease killers, AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria, reaffirming global leadership in support of the Global Fund, strengthening pandemic preparedness, and advancing rights and good governance alongside health. Mark Lagon is also a distinguished senior scholar at Georgetown University's School of Foreign Service. Prior to his post at the Global Fight, Mark Lagon was president of Freedom House. That's an independent watchdog organization dedicated to the expansion of freedom and democracy around the world. He also served as ambassador at large to combat trafficking in persons at the U.S. Department of State. Historically, the United States has led the world's fight against HIV/AIDS through investments in PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, which began under former President George W. Bush, and the Global Fund, which is the largest financier of global HIV programming after PEPFAR. And Ambassador Mark Lagon is no stranger to these VOA microphones. He has been a regular guest on our annual Foreign Policy Preview Encounter program, which we broadcast every January from Georgetown University. And he joins us now via Microsoft Teams to update us on the work of the Global Fight and the organization's recommendations to the incoming Biden administration. Mark Lagon, welcome back to the program.
Carol, it's always good to be with you. Good to be with you, Rick, too.
Thank you.
Well, Mark Lagon, let me start with asking you about your organization's primary message for the incoming Biden administration, which I sort of summarized, but I'd like to hear it in your words, regarding the U.S. global leadership role regarding COVID-19 and other epidemics and health security in general.
The United States has committed itself for a long time to working with other countries to end AIDS, malaria, and TB. COVID-19 has shown that U.S. health security is intimately tied to the health security of other countries. I think recognition has developed in the United States that we're only as safe as the world's weakest health system. And there's a wonderful opportunity for a new presidential administration to boost U.S. leadership, a kind of U.S. leadership that's cooperative in style and thinks about investing in and working with other countries on health security. That's what we're recommending.
Of course, we know that President Trump has decided to pull out of the World Health Organization, something that President-elect Biden intends to rejoin on day one after he's inaugurated in January. So I assume that is heartening for you.
The approach to the WHO should surely be to mend it, not end it. The U.S. should contribute to strengthening a truly essential asset in the world for surveillance, guidance on health, the World Health Organization. But we should look to other multilateral organizations and partnerships that have had a lot of value to offer. You know, the Global Fund to fight AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria has been very effective on the three diseases that it has fought, contributing to 38 million lives being saved since 2002. But it has jumped into dealing with the COVID-19 situation by creating a response mechanism, a COVID-19 response mechanism. It's helped 106 countries and in 14 cases, multi-country groups with nearly $600 million in aid to try and mitigate the way that COVID-19 has thrown off the response to HIV, TB, and malaria, especially for the most vulnerable and stigmatized populations.
And Mark, before I turn to my colleague Rick to jump in, remind us once again about the primary objectives of your organization, the Global Fight. We've had you before, but we want to remind our listeners about your overall objectives.
Friends of the Global Fight Against AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria is the chief advocacy organization for the Global Fund to fight AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria. That's a partnership that works with countries, governments, business, civil society to fight those three diseases. And the end of AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria is our goal. But ending epidemics in general should be the aim of the United States and the world. And the Global Fund's been working to build health systems in countries that help with any arising pandemic, not just the three that it was created to address.
Mark, you mentioned the COVID-19 pandemic, and people are so focused on issues brought on by the pandemic as it continues to worsen with no end in sight. For most people, efforts to end or at least severely mitigate the pandemic has become the most important public health issue right now. In the briefing paper released by your organization, U.S. Global Health Leadership for a Safer and More Equitable World Report, it said that, quote, we cannot be confident in our ability to address COVID-19 and future pandemics if we do not commit to finishing the job on the longstanding pandemics that kill millions annually, AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria. Can you explain what is meant by that?
Well, the United States has helped countries and helped partnerships develop an infrastructure for fighting HIV, AIDS, TB, and malaria. And we should use those. We should use those to fight arising pandemics, but it's really silly not to finish scale approaches that have manifestly worked for preventing HIV/AIDS, for giving treatment to those who have HIV/AIDS, whether it's young women or vulnerable populations around the world. It's really silly not to scale the approach to finish the job on those. Rather than turn to all other fights. We can do both, and they should be built on stronger health systems across all of those fights.
And on the Friends of the Global Fight Against AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria website, I read that the COVID-19 pandemic is having a catastrophic impact on the most vulnerable communities worldwide, and it threatens progress against HIV, TB, and malaria. How is this so, and does this mean that the COVID-19 pandemic is playing a role in possibly rolling back all the progress that is made to fight AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria?
If we don't address COVID-19 as a world community and the United States playing its part to assist a decade of progress against HIV, TB, and malaria could be lost and reversed. Let me put it this way. The Global Fund works with partners on the ground in over 100 countries. It has taken surveys and it has found that a high proportion of the programs to combat HIV, to combat TB, to combat malaria have been disrupted. Services have been disrupted. The U.S. program on HIV/AIDS, the president's emergency program for AIDS relief, recently have found that antiretroviral treatment for HIV-positive pregnant women is down by 4.5%. There's been a 25% decline in initiating people on HIV treatment in all age groups. And there's been a decline in HIV case identification because of reduced testing. Why is that? Both because of COVID-19 and because of lockdowns.
In an opinion piece you co-wrote in the publication The Hill, you write, genuine health security for America recognizes that we are only as safe as the world's weakest health system. How do you define health security? And can you please explain what is meant by we are only as safe as the world's weakest health system?
Well, it's not surprising that many of the American people are concerned about how COVID-19 has been ravaging its population. But obviously, COVID-19 came from abroad, and our lives, our travel, our health, our economy are attached to other countries that are dealing with it as well. We can't just respond to COVID-19 by trying to create pandemic preparedness bureaucracies in the U.S. and rich countries. We need to work with low and middle-income countries, not just to increase their surveillance to spot new diseases, but have strong, resilient health systems. It's not an either-or proposition to focus on the U.S. or on the health of in other countries. And so the U.S. encouraging other countries to spend money on their own community health workers and health systems, and the United States stepping forward to assist, particularly through the Global Fund, is in our self-interest.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Mark Lagon, Chief Policy Officer at the Friends of the Global Fight Against AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria. I'm Carol Castiel, along with Rick Pantaleo, broadcaster and producer with VOA's Current Affairs Desk. And this is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download from our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Well, here's a shout out to a loyal listener and Facebook fan, Timothy Arazu from Abuja, the capital of Nigeria. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send us feedback via email to PCUSA@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our special guest, Mark Lagon. Mark, look, there's a lot of politics, budgeting, obviously involved in expanding investments in global health security. But first, a basic question. How different do you anticipate a Biden administration would be with regard to global health funding and investments versus the Trump administration? How do you see these two administrations differing?
Well, I will say that there is a strong bipartisan consensus, despite our very divided political system, on global health. Among the forms of non-military foreign assistance, there's a really strong consensus that global health is more impactful and one of the most important areas the U.S. can work on. But I do think, and that's particularly the case with HIV, where the United States has staked an investment to work with others. I think you can expect the Biden administration to invest more. In fact, the Friends of the Global Fight report is appealing to think more broadly than merely pandemic preparedness that would look to combat something that is very similar to COVID-19, but to invest more broadly. To invest more broadly in the health of low and middle income countries, you know, is very much in our interest. In fact, we recommend that President Biden in his first budget request begin to lay the groundwork for a doubling of U.S. funding for global health. That would still remain a very small proportion of the U.S. budget, well under 1%.
no question about it. Many people are under the mistaken impression that somehow investments in aid and in international development are a large portion of our budget, but they are really not a minute percentage. But Mark, let me ask you, given the gridlock we're seeing and the fact that it's likely, although it's not necessarily certain, we'll only know in January, that the Senate will remain in Republican hands, how optimistic are you that the Congress will, in fact, double annual global health funding over the next 5 years, as you are recommending, especially when it can't pass a COVID relief bill to help our states, local governments, small and medium businesses right now?
Well, it's a very good question. And I think there'll be increasing discussion about budget deficits in the United States as time goes on. It is an utter shame that states has not been able to, in the last six months, come to agreement between Republicans and Democrats on a COVID relief appropriations package, which would help the American people and those abroad who are facing COVID-19. But I do have hope. And I spend a lot of time with Republican and Democratic politicians and their staff. And I find that they really do want to have some area of cooperation. And I have hope that health is an area where there has been some cooperation in the past and that we can expand it. Last year, the dysfunctional U.S. political system came to a consensus to increase funding for the Global Fund to fight AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria by 16%, a 16% increase at a time that there's skepticism about foreign aid and during the Trump era. I think we can build out on that desire to grapple with health security, sort of combining a sense of the U.S. moral leadership role, but our own interests as well.
That's interesting. And I'm not surprised, really. And there may be a silver lining to this horrific COVID pandemic. It underscores how we are simply an interrelated world. There are no borders. You can get on a plane and you have something, you're going to transmit it to the other side of the world. And that may be a silver lining to this horrible pandemic.
I think there's also something worth thinking about is that vaccines are very important to the response, but you also need to have detection, diagnostics, as well as therapies for those who get a disease like COVID-19. And so, you know, we need to think about the Vaccine Alliance, Gavi, but we also need to think about something like the Global Fund and the WHO to get all those diagnostic and therapeutic parts of the solution dealt with, too.
It seems that the Biden transition team is very much interested in this type of cooperation and coordination worldwide, so we shall see. But let me now turn to my colleague, Rick Pantaleo, for another question.
Mark, what you said earlier to Carol regarding vaccines, as you know, regarding the COVID-19 pandemic, there's been a lot of progress, a lot of positive progress in developing vaccines. There are two companies that have product that they're working on that are testing to have between 90 and 95% effectiveness. The one thing that's been running through my mind as these vaccines are coming along is equitable distribution of vaccines. Is the Global Fund involved with this? And what would they do?
It is. There's a general effort among partners called the Access to COVID-19 Tools or the ACT Accelerator. The Global Fund has worked particularly on the diagnostics part and on procurement and deployment of therapeutics, but their equitable access to the vaccine is really important. You know, the business community has, in the form of pharmaceutical companies and other companies, have been great innovators in engines of dealing with a problem. But if there has been a promise of a guaranteed large buy, like a global fund for some of the, the commodities it buys, there's a greater chance of prices being lowered and more equitable access. Our report to the Biden transition, our recommendations are not only focused on a safer world, but a more equitable one. The people, those who are poor, migrants, those who are women, gay men, vulnerable, stigmatized populations have to have access to treatment, and not just vaccines.
We've been talking about government funding for these efforts. What about involvement from corporate and public interest organizations in participating?
Well, the Gates Foundation has been a real leader here. And let me say, just, you know, as disclaimer, the Gates Foundation is a funder of our organization, but it has stepped in with regard to vaccines and trying to scale, you know, the effort to innovate and prepare for production and supply chains for a vaccine. The business community has a lot to offer in innovation and know-how in supply chains. And the Global Fund is among the better partnerships that tries to harness that know-how. The Global Fund's COVID-19 response mechanism is open not just to governments as donors, like Germany that recently dispatched $150 million, but to private sector and philanthropic as well. They can give to that COVID-19 response mechanism.
Mark, turning back to HIV/AIDS, we'll be commemorating World AIDS Day soon on December 1. Do you have any new data on HIV and AIDS ahead of World AIDS Day? What do you know about global trends, where we're succeeding, where we're falling short, to what extent, you know, COVID-19 is impairing this effort to both treat and prevent HIV and AIDS?
Well, it has been remarkable success, the job not finished, but remarkable success in reducing the mortality rates and the incidence of HIV/AIDS since its peak in 2004. PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Program for AIDS Relief, and the Global Fund were two players in that. But it's worrisome to see health systems around the world shaken by COVID-19. And some of the steps to reach the poorest populations, those who don't wish to come forward because they may be stigmatized for, you know, seeking help, they're in trouble. You know, if you, you know, recently was reading about stigmatized populations in Malawi who had been reached by programs that civil society, the local government, the Global Fund had developed, but they're being left behind. So on World AIDS Day, it is an occasion on December the 1st to think about finishing the job on HIV/AIDS and not letting COVID-19 reverse a remarkable amount of progress since 2004, when the disease was at its peak, eliminating an entire generation of the most productive and reproductive people in Africa, for instance.
What can you tell us about the state of play regarding tuberculosis treatment and prevention? Are we seeing setbacks? And then there's also a relationship with HIV/AIDS and also on malaria.
You bet. So TB, there's been a good deal of progress on TB over time. For instance, the Global Fund and its partners have seen a reduction in the annual mortality by 25% since the time the Global Fund was created in 2002. But there are two problems. One is there are forms of TB that are resistant to treatment. Multi-drug resistant TB in Southeast Asia, some of the five major ways of treating TB, up to four of them may no longer work because of the mutating form of the disease. Secondly, there are lots of examples, many millions of cases of TB that are unfound, latent cases. The WHO recently said there might be 200,000 to 400,000 more deaths this year from TB than previously projected because of COVID-19, and that could continue at about a million new cases and deaths occurring each year for 5 years if we don't grapple with both TB and COVID-19.
Mark, just quickly, how about malaria, which is more endemic, I guess, in the tropical countries? Are we backsliding? Are we seeing progress? Is COVID, again, reversing any of the gains in that area?
It is indeed. Global Fund has found disruption of malaria programs as well. Think about the case of in lockdown of a family that was urged to take a child to the clinic immediately with a fever because a fever that lasted, 72 hours could be associated with a malaria death. Well, what do you do in a situation of COVID-19? Malaria bed nets, such as those created by the Vestergaard Corporation, are developing a new generation that overcome resistance to insecticides. If you can't distribute them, or you can't get poor populations to concentrate on the need to use the bed nets that they get, there's going to be backward progress. There's been elimination or progress towards elimination of malaria in a number of countries in Latin America and Africa, just a danger of backward movement due to COVID-19.
Mark, back to the transition paper your organization released recently. I know we're running out of time, but can you give us an understanding of the 5 listed actions?
Sure. I mean, first off, important things cost money. And the U.S. can make very consequential increased global health investments and build on a comparative advantage that it has already had in the form of PEPFAR, the President's Malaria Initiative, and the Global Fund. Secondly, the United States should return to the world stage, not be a sharp-elbowed unilateral actor, but offer leadership to end AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria, something we can build on towards greater health security. The United States should offer leadership, thirdly, in support of the Global Fund. And in fact, when the Global Fund hosts a conference for replenishment and its future, the United States should step up and offer leadership again and sustain 33% share. Fourth, we really need to focus on this sense of a genuine health security, and that includes health systems in countries and helping build capacity of community health workers. And then finally, really in sync with, U.S. culture, U.S. values, and President-elect Biden's apparent commitment to those traditions, is to focus our health policy on advancing human rights for women, vulnerable and stigmatized populations, and make sure that health programs and health systems in countries have good governance. Those 5 things would be reinforcing and the basis of a global health strategy re-envisioned.
It sounds like it. And also just national security in general would be bolstered by this type of approach. Mark, as we close, I wonder if you could tell us about any reaction you may have gotten from the Biden transition team. Have they reacted to your proposals?
Well, we've shared it with the very senior leaders of the Biden transition team. And of course, we've shared it, we've sent it to those who are coming into power. But of course, they need to work with others in the political system as well. Some very senior figures who one can expect to land in the administration, but certainly are part of the transition, have thanked us. And I think it's in sync with some things that they're strongly considering.
And just as we close one more time, if you have anything you'd like to share with our audience, our worldwide audience, with respect to what you're doing and what your hopes are as we go forward, with respect to pandemic preparedness for treatments and basically improving, as you said, health systems, vulnerable health systems, especially in developing countries.
I put it two ways. There are 2 false dichotomies that we need to eschew, to set aside. One is that the security and the health of the American people is somehow separate from the health security of those in other countries, including low and middle income countries. And then secondly, while we properly focus on finishing the job on AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria, where there's bipartisan support since the Bush era, we also need to address more general health security and strengthened systems of health that are resilient in other countries, not in a completely, you know, diffuse effort, but one that will help end epidemics as we know it and make people more productive, happy, thriving, and peaceful as partners in the world.
Mark Lagon is Chief Policy Officer at the Friends of the Global Fight Against AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria. He's former president of Freedom House and retired ambassador. Mark, thank you so much for sharing your recommendations for the incoming Biden administration about global public health priorities. We greatly appreciate it.
It's a delight to join Voice of America and you, Carol and Rick.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Gary Jaffe. And joining me on the program was VOA science expert Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join us again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.